What I want to focus on is data and statistics and facts, because they just seem to be completely ignored, you know, unless they serve a purpose. So the MHRA yellow card reports have were recently gathered and put together by a researcher who is assisting quite a number of people, including Doctors for COVID Ethics, and I think Robin Menotti, who has a Telegram channel. And UK Column actually created a sort of searchable database for the MHRA yellow card data, because on the MHRA website, you can't search through it. It's a really clunky, hard to use system, although apparently they have now announced that they're actually going to launch a new system, which is kind of strange considering right at the beginning of this year, when they were talking about, beginning the vaccination process, MHRA had actually put out a tender for a new AI system that they could use to, to document all of the what they said, anticipated high numbers of adverse events. So everybody seemed to be well aware of the fact that because this was an experimental injection, or all of these various vaccines, all of them administered in the UK are experimental, they went ahead and, got this new system. They sent out a tender for a new system, and yet now they're talking about relaunching it again. So there's no transparency here. I don't know what's going on. Why at the beginning of the year did they not implement it? Even though they actually put out a tender, did they not actually get round to putting in the new system? Have they been using the old system all this time and now they're finally launching the new system? What's going on?
Well, perhaps nobody actually came up with a decent response to their tender.
Perhaps. But anyway, I mean, they are being overwhelmed, even though potentially the reporting numbers are actually much lower than reality, because most of these systems are underreported, not overreported. But because there have been staggering numbers of injuries, their system must just be creaking. But they're clearly not doing anything about it. They're not investigating all of these events. So here's the latest data from the 24th of November. And total adverse reactions in the UK are now close to 1.3 million. So there have been nearly one, well, by now, there's probably 1.3 million adverse reactions. That's not the number of people injured. That's because each person may have more than two or three adverse reactions. So that's why it's 1.3 million. And there are over, by their own reporting, these are what are logged, successfully logged into the system. Over 1,800 deaths, fatalities from these jabs. And that's very significant. I think that never in the history of the last 60, 70 years, has a vaccination procedure carried on for so long, a program has never carried on for so long with so many deaths, so many adverse reactions with no halt in place and no no research investigations into the causes in place, and furthermore with an acceleration of the process and, you know, an added additional with these booster programs. So it's just, it's simply astonishing. If you look at the numbers of people who have reported, for example, nervous system disorders, over 250,000 reports of nervous system disorders have been logged. Over 154,000 muscle and tissue disorders have been logged. General disorders, gastric disorders, blood disorders, cardiac disorders, pregnancy, congenital disorders, over 2,000 pregnancy disorders, over, you know, even psychiatric disorders, over 27,000 psychiatric disorders. It's just quite staggering to me.
Maybe not staggering, Catherine, because there's never been a vaccination program like this. And I suppose the other question is there any kind of threshold, you know, that beyond which, if you're having, you know, X percentage of adverse reactions, where someone somewhere will pull the plug?
Well, we don't know, because they've never stated that. There's been no risk benefit analysis throughout any of this, these last 21 months. There's been nothing, has there? If there has been, they haven't come out and said so. What's a tolerable level of harm from their point of view?
One can assume that it could even go anywhere up to 100% adverse reactions to the vaccine, and they still wouldn't pull it.
Well, I mean, there is, somebody argued this in terms of a philosophical point, that if only one person is saved and 99 people are harmed, it's considered valid. And, you know, I don't know how you start making those sorts of calculations. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the vaccines, as I demonstrated in last week's talk, they do not protect. The mRNA ones do not protect. The DNA ones do not protect against a respiratory infection, which enters the body via the eyes, nose, and mouth. It simply is scientifically unfounded. It doesn't work. So therefore, if it's an ineffectual product, then surely any level of harm is simply unacceptable, because
there are other things like TB, for example. You know, there are some that, you know, have been helped by medical procedures in the past. But I mean, there must be some way of doing this. In other words, looking at what is your best possible treatment for individuals with no vaccine, and what outcomes you get there, and then looking at the damage to people via the vaccine versus you know, the chance of, for example, them not being hospitalized. And then there's also, of course, the fact that down the line, the vaccine may have, and many people have, many, you know, qualified doctors, not just anybody, have been suggesting that these mRNA vaccines may cause autoimmune disease long down the line, that is decades into the future. Someone may die maybe 20, 30 years before they would have done originally, because of getting an autoimmune disease, because of the nature of these mRNA so-called vaccines, and what they're doing is producing this potentially in an organ in the future, something which could kill you 10 years down the line, 20, 30 years down the line, which hasn't really been looked at.
No, none. I mean, there is no data. So this is a live experiment, and they are still experimenting on us. I mean, that, or those who are taking it. This is a live experiment until 2023, at which point they should then do a cumulative, that would be the end of this study period. However, you know, that they've unblinded the control group, and so there are no there are no control groups anymore in these so-called trial phases. This is phase three trials that nobody seems to be, well, very few people who are still in the dark know that this is still in phase three trials. This is on a massive scale. I mean, normally phase three trials should be done in the thousands of people. This is being done on the millions of people, you know, across the globe. And so there has been no science. And so it's incredible for them to stand on the stage, you know, and keep insisting that what they're doing is science. It isn't. There is no science anymore, and there seemed to be very little science at all in what they did. So the other thing, I mean, that really backs this up, and I mentioned it last week, but I'd not had much time to go into the details, were these Pfizer documents that a group of professionals for transparency sought to be exposed. So Pfizer obviously has enormous numbers of documents pertaining to this new injection that and all the deals they did and all the so-called trials, which Merrill Nass, who is a researcher into all of these and a medical doctor herself, describes as fake trials. I mean, their trials are not, they're just not according to the norms and standards of medical trials. These documents, which apparently number now to about 450,000 pages, Pfizer has, and these professionals sought, with a Freedom of Information request, they sought to have these documents released to the public. So they went to the FDA and they requested an FOI to have these Pfizer documents exposed or released. The FDA went to a judge and said, okay, we will do this, but we require 55 years in order to process this data. So it will take us to release them, they said originally, 500 pages a month. They would release this information by 500 pages a month. And they said it would take 55 years to do that. So, of course, the professionals immediately said, well, hang on a minute, that's unacceptable. We don't accept that. You know, the FDA gave Pfizer the license to be used within 108 days. You know, they gave, I don't know if it was the emergency regulatory, the emergency use or whether it was the license, but it was 108 days. From which Pfizer was started to be administered to the general public. So they said, we don't see why, if the FDA can license a product in 108 days, why they cannot also insist that these documents are released within 108 days. And to that, Pfizer responded and said, actually, we've discovered we have more documents. Initially, they said they had about 300,000 documents. They then came back and said, actually, we've discovered that we have over 450,000 documents, and we now need 75 years in order to release this information at 500 pages a month. Now, this is still being agreed upon, you know, this is going through legal channels. How can a product which is still in trial phase, which has no, whether the manufacturers and the producers have no liability, is being mandated or basically forced in the form of coercion on the general public. And yet the data that they have on the efficacy, the legitimacy, the safety of the product is being withheld for up to 75 years. It's just, it's nonsensical. We're living in some kind of, I don't know, Alice in Wonderland.
Well, it sounds also like maybe they're just making fun of us, making fun of the US courts, and maybe they control those courts.
Well, I don't know if they control, certainly there are, you know, influences, but it's up, it would be very, very blatant, I think, if the judgment comes back that, yes, this is completely acceptable, that it should take them such a long time to release all of the documents. Clear example of regulatory capture and, you know, the complete corruption of our, you know, judicial system. I believe there have to be still some honorable judges and honorable people within the regulatory authorities themselves. But, you know, there really is such an overwhelming amount of data now, and the abuse of power, the complete anti-science that is being practiced at the moment. It's just, you know, it's more and more apparent every day. And on that note, within the Doctors for Ethics group of individuals, they have started to search for research papers documenting the vaccine injury. And so apparently, according to them, now on PubMed, there are more and more examples of research papers now that are linking, are directly linking these vaccines to medical harm, to physical injury. So maybe, you know, it's becoming undeniable at this stage. So that was one aspect. The other aspect which I wanted to draw attention to was how the data itself in the UK is being manipulated. There is a very dedicated honourable man, Norman Fenton, Professor Norman Fenton, who you may have heard of, who is the who is a professor of mathematics at I think it's at St Mary's at Mary's University in London, and he's been doing some data analysis of data that was published by the Office for National Statistics. And Office for National Statistics, you know, they put out a huge amount of data. And what they put out at the end of September, so they'd produced a set of graphs and data that basically logged the deaths between people they classified as unvaccinated and those as vaccinated. And it looked from a very cursory sort of looking at of the data, it appeared that, in fact, unvaccinated people were dying at far greater levels than vaccinated people. And so this it is, you know, what people seem to be reporting in the news. Oh, you know, so, you know, hospitals are full of unvaccinated people and unvaccinated people are dying at far greater numbers and so on and so forth. Professor Fenton decided he would actually dig into these these graphs and really analyze them. And what the results he came to are quite stark, and he actually talked about them on LBC on their program, and he explained what he thinks is happening. So there are these spikes. Okay, when you look at ONS data and previously Public Health England data, there are these really unusual spikes that do not really resemble any sort of natural viral infection in a population. If you look at seasonal viral infections over the course of many years, over say 10 years, and you look at those graphs, those mortality graphs, there are distinct and they are repeated year on year. Some years there are slightly higher curves with higher numbers of mortality figures, and other years it's a slightly lower curve, but it's always a fairly obvious bell curve. You know, there has not been, if you look at the graphs, any type of sharp, almost like a V-shaped, conical-shaped spike in mortality figures when there are natural, seasonal influenza epidemics. You know, I'm not talking about pandemics, but epidemics that just go through the population normally in the winter months. Now, he looked at specifically the data from January of this year to September, which is what was released by Office for National Statistics, which he was referring to. He broke it down by age groups, and he noticed that the spikes in terms of the specific age groups. So first of all, he looked at the 80 and above age groups, and we know that you know, they started jabbing people from the older age group, so from the 80 and above age groups in January to February. And the number of 80 and above deaths spiked right around that time. So right in that time frame, just as those jabs were being administered to that age group, that age group's mortality spiked. So then he looked at the next age group, the 75 and above. And again, they spiked when their jabs were being administered. And then he looked down at the next age group, 60 and above, or however they're being divided. And again, there was a spike. Obviously, as you go down the age groups, the numbers of people who were dying reduced. So in the 80 and above age group, you know, within a week or two, we're talking about 1,500 people dying in that age group. And then as you go down the age groups, categories, it was, you know, reduced. So in the 70s and above, it was something like around 600 and so on. And it dropped. So into the age 40 and above, there was a little spike, but it was in the region of around 40 or 50. I don't know if that's in total or whatever, but that the graphs, you know, you could see on the graph the actual numbers of people who died reduced on the left-hand side of the graph. So he argues that because people are categorized as unvaccinated until 2 weeks after their first dose, and then until another 2 weeks after their second dose, it is conceivable, and it looks very likely that the people that they categorized as unvaccinated on the ONS graphs are in fact the people who did receive a vaccine, but were still within the 2-week window of being classified as unvaccinated. And that's how it looks to him. And of course, his other, you know, colleagues who research with him. And this information was presented on LBC. So I think, you know, well-intentioned, good-hearted people who are really determined to get to the bottom of this are not going to let go of this sort of data. And they're not going to let go of this sort of evidence, really, of the huge amounts of harm that have already been done. I mean, from the very beginning, from about June, July of last year, I started looking, and maybe even before, maybe in May, I started regularly looking at office ONS figures, their sort of regular output of information of numbers of deaths and, you know, how they break all the information down. And I paid attention to where people were dying. And it's very, and I've gone back actually this week, and I've gone back and looked at those, the data for the entire sort of 20-month period. And it's very strange. What happened in the UK and in probably all the countries that conducted these very harsh lockdown and school closure and so on policies, coupled with a very sort of persistent fear-mongering in the media, probably have very similar things, which is actually what the researcher, Denny, his last name escapes me at the minute. Anyway, he actually published his research based on data that he gathered from around the world. What he showed was that it was actually the public health measures, so-called, quote-unquote, which caused so much harm. And it was not a viral effect. It wasn't a natural sort of viral effect flowing through the population. It was clearly due to the nature of those spikes, public health measures. And when you look at the UK data, it looks very much like that. So in the UK, excess deaths spiked in week 14 of 2020. So, you know, we had been pootling along in 2029, winter of 2029, January 2020. We'd all been pootling along. And actually in the UK, you know, there weren't any excess deaths. It was a very average winter in terms of mortality. And then in week 14, deaths started to just climb through the roof, and they peaked in week 16. So in week 16, there were over 4,000 excess deaths in a hospital and over 5,000 excess deaths in care homes. And that is an excess above the 5-year average. So that is a most extraordinary kind of event, I think. And what
surely that could just simply be people dying of the virus. I mean, the virus was kicking in end of March, week 16 in April. That's surely just simply be the virus. And maybe, you know, the health service not quite sure how to treat it, treating people who were dying of SARS for something else, for example, through using respirators when they shouldn't have been. I mean, that's surely the virus that's killing those people.
Well, a viral infection doesn't spike like that. I think that's what I've been trying to explain, is that, you know, it doesn't. And if you look at countries where they didn't take these sorts of measures, you know, where they didn't lock down, there weren't the same spikes. Those spikes didn't occur. So, I mean, I think it's been established now that even in the mainstream media, I think it was carried in the Telegraph very early on last year, or maybe not early on, but it was reported in the Telegraph that, you know, some 28,000, I think, around that number, of very elderly, poorly patients who were in hospital were basically shuffled out of hospital quickly because of this panic that was created, you know, to empty the hospitals and ensure that there would be plenty of beds for poorly patients, even though these elderly people were already there because they were poorly. They were shunted into care homes. They were basically left with virtually no treatment, no doctor's visits. We now know that they were prescribed midazolam and morphine. And we know that that was happening in the hospitals as well, in terms of people who were in the ICU units. So it just looks very, very orchestrated. It looks orchestrated to create this sudden big spike in mortality figures to scare people, to sort of say, look.
And also, of course, the families were not allowed to visit people in care homes.
Exactly, families were not allowed to visit. It was isolation of the elderly in the care homes, isolation of people who were in hospital. There was, you know, no oversight, absolute, basically carte blanche for all kinds of abuse to take place. And so we got that spike in mortality. So, you know, straight off the bat, they could, you know, they were reporting this death toll, right? I mean, I wasn't in the UK, but I'm sure you can attest to the fact that straight off the bat, in March of last year, in April of last year, May of last year, it was, you know, the ticker on the TV was about the numbers who had died, and it kept
Those deaths were not being caused by people being told to stay at home. I mean, that doesn't kill people. Just being told you've got to stay at home and not go to work or not, you know, not socialize. I mean, that's really not so much of a killer as it sounds, as if you're talking about the care homes.
Well, so initially, what triggered all of those deaths appears now to be that these elderly people were deprived treatment. You know, they'd been taken out of hospital settings where they presumably were being cared for, into a setting where they didn't have the appropriate levels of care. They were deprived family visits to ensure that they were okay. And the government ordered 2 years' worth of midazolam. I mean, that's on the record. And they've got through it because they've just put in another order of midazolam. And Matt Hancock was recorded discussing this with another MP or about the what they termed a good debt. So they were talking about basically writing off people who they felt would never have the ability to recover from an infection. So very much they were just, you know, declaring these people as being expendable, it seems. So all of a sudden, within about 4 weeks, we had this massive spike in a sort of conical V shape, which is not a viral curve at all. All those people died. Then what happened was excess deaths in hospitals and care homes dropped, just straight down. There was no sort of gentle curve. They just basically collapsed. There were no more excess deaths in the hospital and care home setting. In fact, they ended up going below the five-year average. So there were fewer deaths on average than the previous 5 years in hospitals and care homes. And that continued for a number of months. But what was happening instead was that people dying at home started to increase. They spiked at the time of March and April. So there was an increase in deaths at home as well. That increase has never dropped down to below the five-year average. So since March of 2020 until now, apart from the spike in March and April and then the spike again in December and January of this winter, deaths in homes have stayed around 500 to 1,000 people a week above the five-year average, sustained, never falling down to the base level, never falling below the base level. People dying at home have averaged out over the course of the past 20 months at between 500 and 1,000 excess deaths every week. Now that, when you tot it up, equates to about 58,000 people. And so when I was doing these calculations, very rough on the back of a piece of paper calculations, you have the excess deaths caused by inappropriate treatment of the elderly and vulnerable in care homes and in hospital settings at the commencement of this pseudo pandemic, and immediately off the bat you had around 30,000 deaths in those settings, excess deaths, and then you add the approximately 58,000 that have occurred at home because of any number of reasons for the last 20 months. You've got around 85,000 excess deaths basically caused by the measures taken by this government. And, you know, the numbers of deaths that they continue to say are COVID deaths. You know, I think it's something like 150,000 there. They seem to be, it's a rolling, you know, it's like they've kept the taxi meter rolling, where previously any sort of seasonal influenza, any type of viral infection or epidemic you know, they count it on a 12-month basis, on an annual basis. They've decided globally, in order to, again, to create this monster of a thing, they are keeping this taxi meter ticking over so that in the first year in the UK, within the first 12 months, I think there was something like, based on their definitions as well, of a positive test within 68 days of dying within 68 days of a positive test, and then within 28 days of a positive test. Those definitions, within the first 12 months, there were 68,000 deaths, around that figure. And then since then, there's been another approximately 6,000 deaths or 8,000 deaths. That, you know, is not a pandemic, even by their definitions. And, you know, so the harms, I think, can be demonstrated to be easily far greater than any supposed risk that this virus presents to the majority of the population. So we've established that, I think. And, you know, when they try to maintain that, oh no, the vaccines are safe and effective and they've saved millions of lives, it's all hypothetical. There's no hard evidence behind it. What can be demonstrated by Professor Norman Fenton's analysis of data, that actually vaccines are causing spikes of death in the populations that are receiving them in the age brackets, it looks exactly like what is happening. The fact that you have MHRA, yellow card reporting, collecting data on so many hundreds of thousands of adverse reactions, and the same in Europe, the same in the US, the combined data for deaths within the EU, UK and US is now over 58,000, which, you know, is in their databases of vaccine injury. Over 58,000 people now, and over 3 million people have been, or over 3 million adverse reactions and over 58,000 deaths by these vaccines. Now, I think what should be done now, what people should think about doing, is writing to the MHRA, writing to the head of MHRA, writing to Department of Health and Security, writing to their MPs, and saying at what analysis or what cost benefit analysis have you done to decide that, you know, the levels of harm caused by this experimental injection are greater than the harms that they cause, that the benefit is greater than the harms they cause. What research have you done? And what research or what evidence have you got to show that these recorded adverse reactions and deaths are not caused by this experimental injection? What evidence have you got of that? And what is your evidence? that it isn't caused by it.
Well, I imagine they would reply to you saying, well, we've had something like, certainly 60, 70, 80,000 deaths due to the virus and only 1,000 deaths due to the vaccine in a population which is now something like 80%, 90% vaccinated. So they'll say, well, it's obvious that what we've done has been successful.
But I don't know in why suddenly, you know, there's been a major paradigm shift in terms of what is acceptable. And I think this is what's so incredible, is that this kind of thing is now acceptable. And it's I don't think this sort of thing would have been acceptable 2, 3, 4 years ago. So something has changed. You know, the politicians are being fed a script and they're not doing any of their own research. And they've been warned off it because they think it's all conspiracy theory, and that if you say anything against this program, you're some kind of nutter. You know, but I think it is starting to come apart, which is why they're trying to double down harder. You know, and the booster rate is not going well at all. So the boosters are at much lower rates than the first and second jabs, far, far lower rate. So at some point, this is going to start to come unstuck, I think. But the damage has already been done. And the numbers of people who've received the vaccine are, you know, as we say, they may have injuries for, you know, in 20 years' time, in 10 years' time. And who's to know? You know, it's all a big experiment. And who's going to then care for these people who are injured? What's going to happen to, you know, how they sustain themselves, keep themselves going for the next 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, since we last spoke, Catherine, I had a fascinating hour-long interview with Professor Chris Exley, who you put us on to. This is the chap who was constructively dismissed from his job for 35 years or so as a professor at Keele University, looking into particularly into aluminium. And the reason this links up with these vaccines is that there is aluminium in most, if not all of these, many of these vaccines anyway. The idea of this aluminium is when it gets introduced into the body says, oh my God, what's this doing here? And it provokes some sort of immune response, which apparently the vaccines, this is it, traditional vaccines, wouldn't work without this, all these various cells coming to try and sort the situation out with this aluminium hanging around. And so that it does look as if for many years the industry has been doing things which may well be harmful and detrimental to our health in the long term. He explained that aluminium is not normally in the body at all. It's not normally available out in the environment to go into the body. But now, what with it being in vaccines and it being also in cooking, in pain, you know, basically in food through cooking pans and things like this, he believes the major cause of Alzheimer's, which of course is a massive it's also pretty much an epidemic that's something that didn't really happen, at least many people believe, beyond recent history. And so the vaccine industry seems to have been using this aluminium product for many years, which it it shouldn't have been, and which many of the people who are accepting those vaccines don't. But then also, at the same time, you've got Bill Gates admitting to vaccines being a fantastic investment, giving a 20-to-1 return, which, of course, anybody who's looking now to try and get any interest from their savings in the bank is not going to get.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you talked to him. I think, you know, it's from a historical point of view, I think, you know, if I did a bit more digging into, you know, previous characters in science who tried to flag up the actual harm that was being caused by, you know, let's say, from big chemical agricultural industries, for instance, or the military industrial complex, and now the pharmaceutical industries, there have been many examples where the concerned scientist or doctor or a researcher tries to inform where there was harm being committed, or, you know, whether deliberately or just callously for profit. Those individuals are dismissed, they are disregarded, and smeared and, you know, pushed out, basically. And a totally different narrative is constructed, which buries any concerns and just completely pushes aside any responsibility for those big industries that are basically driven by the profit margin. And so, as Dr. Exley said, or Professor Exley said, the profit margins, when they produce these so-called vaccines with aluminium, are far greater than if they used some other substance that would not be so toxic in the body. And I think, you know, we've seen this over and over again with so many examples of drugs that start off, you know, they are touted as being some great thing that's going to, you know, benefit all these people. I mean, the classic example is thalidomide. And, you know, it was used in pregnant women, I believe, to prevent morning sickness. And the consequences were appalling. And yet, they didn't pull thalidomide off the market for many and many, many years after that. Despite, and in fact, I think it was then actually, you know, sold, despite it being banned in most of the Western world, it was then exported. I haven't got hard and fact proof of that. But that sort of thing goes on all the time, and, you know, we're seeing it now in the form of so-called vaccine justice, you know. So all the progressives are calling for the abolition of patents on these mRNA and DNA jabs, so that, you know, the countries in the global south or the majority world who can't afford the high price tags can produce their own. But in reality, they're treating their patients with things like ivermectin and hydrochloroquine and other things that are off-label, and they're, you know, unbranded, they're cheap as chips, and very, very effective. You know, if they had great numbers of sick patients, which they don't appear to have at any rate, but if they had that, that's what some of these countries are using, and it's working for them.
Well, look, just to drag you back to Chris Exley for a minute, one of the other things he shared with us was that the examinations that they'd done of brains of people who had died with autism also showed large amounts of aluminium in the brain. Now, this takes us back to the famous Andrew Wakefield, ex-Dr. Andrew Wakefield, that had to leave the UK. He's now in the United States, but he was one of the first people to flag up the potential links between the MMR vaccine and autism. And really what Chris Exley is doing is corroborating that. So, and also from what you just said there about the Global South, well, we heard last week from the boss, the president of the World Bank, that the problem there is that the governments are not prepared to accept vaccines because they realise that people will be suing them if they're dead, if they die, or their families will be suing them, and they don't have these, what they call shield, a financial shield against being sued by people injured by the vaccines. And so he was actually talking there about the World Bank insuring these countries so that they can start using the vaccines. And then if people are injured by them, die because of them, the families and the injured can then get their money back from World Bank insurance.
Yes, how convenient. Yeah, I mean, I think that is part of the problem. The UK, the US, our authorities like the MHRA and the NICE in the UK, in the US, CDC and FDA, they're highly corrupt. It's taken many decades, I think, for them to be so thoroughly corrupted, but they are now completely captured by the big pharmaceutical companies and the big chemical and agri companies. And so they got the fix in back in 1986, as I think I said last week. In the US, they passed the Liability Act or CARES Act or whatever it was called in 1986, basically giving carte blanche to all the pharmaceutical companies who produce vaccines. So it's specifically for the category of a product called biologics, which is not the same as traditional medicinal drugs. These products, principally vaccines, so-called vaccines, are exempt. They're you know, and they built into these programs taxpayer-funded schemes whereby those who can prove that they're injured, for example, in the UK, in order to prove that you are injured, or in order to be eligible for a payout from the UK scheme, you have to prove that you're over 60% incapacitated. And I don't know how you demonstrate that. And there's also a time limit. So, you know, I think it's within 2 years of having got the jab. I think it's very difficult to go back historically. So, yes, in these countries, in the US, the UK, and presumably in Canada and Australia and many European countries as well, it's very well stitched up. In other countries, for example, in Japan, although they're beginning to be perhaps more corrupt than before, they're still probably less corrupt. And for example, in Japan, I think they did have a moratorium on the HPV vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine, on young teenage girls. And I think they did also, in terms of the MMR vaccine, they didn't comply with the instruction from above that those jabs should be administered at 12 months, where previously, originally, they were administered at 24 months, the first dose of the MMR. And I think, as Andrew Wakefield and others have shown, because those vaccines can cause, in some children, dramatic overnight changes in their behavior, from being completely mobile and, you know, with good speech development and so on, they regress to becoming nonverbal and with mobility issues. And in an age group like 24 months, around that age group, those sorts of things are well developed. You know, most children are fairly mobile by 2 years, and their speech development is also going in great strides. And it's very noticeable if within 24 hours, let's say, of a jab such as MMR, those things suddenly disappear. That becomes very apparent. And so if you lower the age at which those vaccines are administered to age 12, which is what they are now, not age, but months, 12 months, then it's much harder to discern if there are any noticeable changes in your child. So yes, it's all very dark, it's all very murky, it's very, very, it's incredibly shocking. And when you talk about, in the US, for example, the number of jabs that children get before a certain age, compared to the numbers that we received in our childhood, for example, you know, they're having dozens and dozens of various things jabbed into their bodies at increasingly younger ages. And is it any wonder that the US is leading the world's nations in the number of children who have autoimmune disorders and behavioral issues? When we first came to live in Turkey 11 years ago, and we sent our daughter to local kindergarten and primary school, we had to tell her teachers and her schools that she is allergic to all nuts, every kind of nut. And they couldn't believe it. They had never heard of it. Everywhere we went, whoever we spoke to, and we said, don't give her any food because, you know, it may have nuts in it and she's allergic to all nuts, they looked at us like we were speaking a different language. Food allergies are not, or have not been, a thing at all in Turkey. They did not exist. Just as, I would argue, they didn't exist in our time. I don't recall anybody having a food allergy when I was a child, or even as a teenager. I knew nobody who had food allergies. Again, with Alzheimer's and dementia, in Turkey, you rarely ever hear about elderly people who have Alzheimer's or dementia. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. The rates appear to be far, far lower than in certainly in the UK. Now, one might say that, for example, tinned food is not a very common thing yet in Turkey. Most food does not come out of tinned packages. And also the elder population, you know, generally have not been drinking from cans, you know, fizzy pops in cans. But in addition to that, they haven't been getting the flu jab. You know, for maybe in the last 10 years or so, the public health authorities in Turkey have tried to promote flu jabs for people over the age of 60 and so on. And they have encouraged people to come for their flu jabs. But on the whole, the majority of Turkey's elderly population don't bother with flu jabs. So I think for researchers, academics and researchers like Professor Exley, this is, you know, it would be interesting for them to compare data in populations where there has not been a historical, such high levels historically of vaccination. And again, to your point about the profits, this is, you know, this is very apparent that if you have a product that can be more or less mandated to virtually all newborns, for instance, and then again, you know, boosted several years later at age 5 and then at age 10 and then maybe at age 20, for example, if it can be mandated for pregnant women, if it can be mandated for people over the age of 60 and so on and so forth, with exemption from liability. I mean, it's a who wouldn't want to if they were merely concerned about gross profit making? Who wouldn't be keen to jump on that bandwagon?
Well, that bandwagon, I would suggest, is also, you know, very much tied up with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust here in the UK, which used to be called Boroughs Wellcome in Britain. And one place people can go if they want to find out, you know, where these people are coming from with their vast amounts of wealth that they've got in these foundations, is to go to the Wellcome Trust Museum at Euston in London, which is a most bizarre place. It's a sort of... I think you'd probably call it a transhumanist museum of some sort, where they sort of try and break the body down and say, well, this could be done with the body, this and that can be done with the body. And they seem to be in the business of thinking about, you know, let us design the new humans for the future. But they don't seem to be actually doing a very good job for the most of us. But anyway, I think we'll leave it there this week, Catherine Gunn. Maybe pick up on some of these thoughts about, you know, the mindset of the people behind this. Is it really just about money? Because I tend to think that there's more to it than that, that money is a means to an end for some of these people. But anyway, thanks very much for joining us this week.
All right. Take care.